on Ways and Means, Education Subcommittee for Thursday, February 17th, 2005. Again, good morning, everyone. Just an FYI for the members and the commissioner and audience members. Our chair, Senator Devlin, has a meeting in his district this morning, and he should be arriving sometime over the next 45 minutes or so. Good morning, Commissioner, and if you would like to give us guidance on where you'd like to start this morning, we'll do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Cam Croy-Sparley. I'm the Commissioner for Community Colleges and the Director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. You should have two packages in front of you this morning. One is a letter that has responses to the questions that I was unable to answer yesterday from the table, and I will walk through those. We also found a few errors and a missing slide or two in day two, so we have produced for you another set of day two slides. Thank you. I certainly appreciated the tenor of the conversation yesterday and hope we will continue that today. I would like to start with going over responses to questions, if that suits the chair.
Please go forward.
I'm going to walk quickly through the questions and the answers because they are written and in front of you, but for the benefit of the audience, we probably didn't have enough copies for everyone to have the responses. We're going to start with Senator Gordley asked for an update on the number of high school students who were also taking college courses at the same time. Our analysis says approximately 25,000 students of high school age are also taking college courses. The 13,200 or 52% of those students are dual credit or Tech Prep 2 plus 2 enrolled. Joint Board Senator Walker asked for the purpose statement of the Joint Boards of Education. We have pulled forward for you the statutory language. And in brief, the Joint Boards of Education provides policy direction to implement a PK-16 education connections that will benefit students.
Before you go forward, when is the next meeting of the Joint Boards?
Madam Chair, the full joint boards will meet sometime in the spring. Our last meeting was about 2 weeks ago, mid-January, end of January, and they do have a working group, which is a subset of each of the two boards that develops the work plan for the joint boards, and they are meeting next month.
All right, very good.
The next question was on distance learning. Senator Gordley asked for the number of students earning degrees online. I have to say I thought that was an important question because this is information I did not have. Of the 8,702 degrees and certificates that were awarded last year, 3,280 or 38% of all recipients were enrolled in at least one distance learning class. Of that, 7.9% of the students completed more than half of their coursework online, and of that 2% did their complete coursework online. Map location, Representative Wisnett observed that we had misplaced Central Oregon Community College. The map has now been corrected. We thank him for his observation. Here we go.
Would you like to repeat that?
Yes. Map location. This is, I'm reviewing questions from and comments from yesterday. Representative Wisnett observed that the location of Central Oregon Community College was improperly placed, and we wanted to let you know we have corrected our map. We also noticed that the way in which we had displayed the map, we had cut off Mount Hood's degrees and awards that were on the map, so we've also fixed that. We had a conversation yesterday about the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps and the lottery funds. A question from Representative Jensen, if the park and recreational department's funds were lottery funds. They are lottery funds, and there is about $300,000 of support they provide, although when we receive them, they are other funds. Again, the question on the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, Senator Gordley asked about progress towards diversifying the Corps members, and our data, which we will show today, is that self-reported demographic information by the participants say that 26% report themselves as non-white. Representative Jensen also had a question about a correlation between high unemployment, meaning and does that mean high enrollment or should it mean high enrollment? And this is the study that we alluded to yesterday that was conducted by the Oregon Community College presidents and their institutional researchers suggest that there is a strong indication of a dramatic increase, that the dramatic increase in tuition charged by the colleges due to a lack of state resources has closed the door on some students. The full report is attached. There was a question on degrees, students, and outcomes. Representative Wisnett asked about the number of degrees awarded and the number of students who pursued them. Of the 12,713 students anticipated to complete an award in 2002-03, 68 or 8,700 did complete. Budget note changes on reimbursement for personal enrichment. Representative Jensen asked about specific information on workforce-related training as it relates to the outcomes of the budget note, and we have provided here the definition of what is workforce-related. And briefly, it includes primarily non-credit literacy, conversational foreign language and American Sign Language, life skills, technology, and categories that fall into career exploration, legal topics, areas for small business, and patents. Senator Gordley asked about the impact of no longer providing reimbursement for personal enrichment on the communities of the colleges, and we have attempted to answer that question, although we believe a full answer would require us to have a conversation with the colleges themselves. We have pulled forward for you data from our reporting system about what the number of enrollments currently look like. And briefly, there has been a loss of approximately 3,700 full-time equivalents, or a 47% decrease since 2002. And there are fewer students, about 28% decrease in students as a result of the legislative budget note. And those would be students who were primarily attending college for the personal enrichment or adult continuing ed. Later this morning, President Schuette will talk about the impact of the loss of adult continuing ed in her comments. Representative Jensen asked, and that I see an error in my letter. We have elevated him quickly from representative to senator. And here he comes. Ask if community colleges have concerted efforts toward leveraging private donations and endowments. Again, given the time frame, and if the committee wishes, we can more fully develop this response, but from data that has been provided, the Legislative Fiscal Office, which includes a review of the community college budgets and their audit documents, it was reported in 2002-03 at $27 million in endowments. I think it's safe to say that each and every community college is actively pursuing additional funds and fundraising efforts. There was not a question, but an error that we found in yesterday's slides. We incorrectly listed the dollar amount of federal resources the department receives for adult basic education. We had in error reported it as $9.8 million. It is $11.2 million. So corrected that information. And attached you have the map and the executive summary and the full report on the variables that connect lower state support, increasing tuition and enrollment.
Madam Speaker.
Representative.
Chair.
Representative Wisnot, good
morning.
Thank
you very much. That's the first time in a month and a half I've been here that we've had response that quick, so thank you, Commissioner, for getting us answers to that quickly. That's nice. The Commissioner did comment, Madam Chair, and I think I would like to see the endowments and donations so we sort of see where the colleges stand if we're going to make some determinations about equalization and things like that. It would be nice to see how each community college stands with their endowment funds and their fundraisers maybe and anything else that they're doing to help with the tuition cost or their funds. I don't guess in this process we're going to look at each community college's budget, or we'll do that in the second phase. So.
We will have the opportunity to get to that level of detail. That's my understanding.
Yes. We'll have information on community college budgets. The state appropriation is to the system as a whole, and historically you do not provide specific funding levels to each college, but provide an amount for distribution through the community college support fund to the 17
colleges. So the follow-up to that, to the Chair and to Mr. Bender, is, but how are we going to, so we can, through direction or notes or however, talk about how the formula, because that's a big concern of my community college, is the distribution formula. So we can, when we give the money, we can say, can we direct how it's given?
You could, yes.
Okay.
And I would anticipate, having served on this committee before, that we will have quite a discussion on the distribution formula, carrying forward concerns and issues from the previous session. Let me just stop here and say to our audience members who are standing, there are seats right up front. If you would like to come on up and take those, we want you to be comfortable this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner, please continue. Representative Jensen, I'm
thank you.
Beg your pardon.
No, that's fine. I just barely raised it. Just for point of clarification, when we are talking about the endowments at all, gambit of things, these would not be part of the funding formula. Maybe this is direction to staff rather than to they're part of the funding formula, would they? These are exterior from. And fundamentally, what the community colleges would do with that money is their business. Am I correct? Within some parameters, I suppose.
Yes. The endowments of the individual colleges is not a component in determining their funding in the existing community college support funds.
Okay. And would have no influence on the distribution formula.
Correct.
Please continue.
Thank you. This morning, we're going to spend time walking through the performance measures and the budget priorities for the department. We wanted to begin today by reviewing again the delivering on the department mission, and you'll see the graphic that we used yesterday with some highlights. We use all the resources that come to the department to reach these results. For the federal resources that we use, we actually negotiate with each federal department what our performance should be based on past experience and future expectations.
You are now on page two of
yes.
the day two document,
yes.
members.
Thank you. A year ago, Oregon met or exceeded all of its federal performance requirements for the Workforce Investment Act, which has 17, the Adult Literacy Program, which has 8, and Postsecondary Carl Perkins, which has 7. So for a total of 32 performance measures, Oregon met or exceeded all of them. And because of that, we received an additional $750,000 that was called an incentive award. States are incented to meet or exceed their performance measures. What Oregon did with that resource was to convene a group of our stakeholders from the community colleges and our workforce partners, and together they have designed a plan for how to use that incentive dollars to create more career pathways for students and working adults. Just to review, although it is not a performance measure per se, I did note yesterday that community colleges have been rated one of the top two public services since 1994. We've been the top rated service at 92% for 3 years, and this year in 2002, community colleges were the second rated at having a very good to somewhat good rating from the public at 88%. Parks and open spaces is number one, just so you know. Yesterday we mentioned that you have an annual report that is called Stronger Together, and in it, it has sidebar stories in that report which really highlight the results, and their personal results, individual results. Today I'm going to talk about both inputs and outputs so that you can see who's coming into the system and the success as they leave the system. We'll talk about community college demographics, and we'll talk about the students that we see coming to community colleges and share the results of what's been accomplished at community colleges. And then we'll also talk about the federal workforce investment dollars, the adult basic skill dollars, and Carl Perkins and OYCC. The reason that I pause here is because these results can get somewhat eye-glazing, and so we have tried to add the face of people to each of them. And so you remember that it's not just numbers, it is people. Given the interest yesterday of the committee, this is one of your new slides. This is the President Council report and the analysis and forecast of what happens with declining resources and increasing tuition. And the report is attached, but I wanted to give you a few highlights. It was a model that was developed to predict what would have happened to college enrollment if funding had not been reduced. If funding had not been reduced and tuition had not been increased, what could we have expected? And we looked back, and then we looked forward. This is definitely the royal we. They looked back, and then they looked forward. The study projects that if tuition and funding growth had remained at pre-recession or pre-2001 levels, community colleges would be serving 65,000 more students today than they are. Is often we get the question of need. Is there a documented need of community college students? And our response is yes. In 2001, we were serving 96,000 students. We believe that given the data that was presented yesterday, we could be at 103,000 students today. Instead, we're at 88,000 students. We've lost 7,100 students. That's full-time equivalent students. I'd like to now, I'm on slide number 6, as we begin the conversation about performance, to share with you a quote that I use often in my office. Not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. That's Albert Einstein, and I use it quite a lot because we want to make sure that we are measuring our success, but we also want to make sure that our arms are wide and our inputs are reflective of our community. So what you see here in this slide are the inputs? Who's enrolling in community college and in what kind of programs? We had in my last comments, total enrollment for community colleges in 2002-03 was 93,000. We reimbursed for 88,000. So if you see, if you were to go to add the numbers with percentages together, I want to make sure that I'm going to be try to be consistent in using the reimbursable FTE.
Would you repeat that again?
Yes, ma'am. Total FTE, so total full-time equivalent students served in 2003-04 was 93,221. Reimbursable full-time equivalents were 88,837. If we look back, we have increased enrollment in community colleges over the last decade by about 10.6%. But since 2001-02, we have lost most of it. We have lost 8.9% of our enrollment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Commissioner, I do not want you to go home and have your staff look this up, but just on your experience, are these numbers of people going to lower division college and all, these numbers are pretty steady for the last 10 years? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, yes and no. The numbers that are pretty consistent are lower division collegiate. It has increased slightly, but only slightly, over the last 4 to 6 years. It's a fairly stable number. Professional, technical, pre-collegiate developmental education as a total shifts between 3 and 5% growth and loss. But we are seeing a loss, which I will cover later, of part-time students in professional, technical, and adult basic education programs.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. If I can follow up on Representative Lisnett's question, or expand it maybe just a little bit more, is the increase in the lower division, that slight that you're talking about, is that because of the possibility that some of the previous professional technical courses have become accepted collegiate transfer courses, or is it strictly just a growth in the traditional?
Madam Chair and Representative Jensen, it has, I believe, more to do with the cost of providing these programs. The professional, as I mentioned yesterday, the professional technical programs are the most expensive to operate.
Okay.
The lower division transfer are some of the least expensive, being primarily lecture.
Thank you.
On slide 7, we talk about enrollment varies for a community college student. If you're a full-time student, a half-time student, or a part-time student, what we have in this particular graph is looking at the last 3 or 4 years of how students are enrolling or not. You will notice that more than 80% of the community college students that attended in 2003-04 were attending part-time. 9% of our enrollments are full-time, and 11% attend half-time. In 2001-03, 83% of our students were attending part-time. So we have lost some part-time students. I wanted to make a note that while full-time enrollment has remained stable and half-time has dropped slightly, significant decline in part-time enrollment has occurred. It's also important to know that full-time students are eligible for both federal and state financial aid, while part-time students are generally not, and certainly not in Oregon, where we have not had sufficient resources to fund part-time students out of the Oregon Need Grant.
Madam Chair. Senator Walker.
Thank you. Ms. Press-Raleigh, this was discussed yesterday, primarily the types of loans that are available to students at community colleges come from the Perkins grant, or do we get other federal grants and loans?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I am not a financial aid specialist. I would say that most community college students have access to the Pell grant financial aid that's federal. I do know that there has been Perkins loans in the past, but I think they are being, if they haven't already been, they're being eliminated.
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, I'll follow up with that. That's the proposal by the Bush administration, but I don't think that's going to fly. But I think my point was that there's a significant number of community college and vocational students who access the Perkins loan rather than the Pell Grant program. And so the point I'm trying to make is that that really has an impact on students being able to attend community colleges.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, well, I absolutely agree with you. As I said, I'm not a financial aid expert. I'd like to bring back a response about Perkins loans for community college students. It's something I'm only vaguely aware of.
Okay. Thank you.
But I certainly don't argue the point that post-secondary and secondary Perkins is a valuable program and should be maintained.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for the report back, Madam Chair. I don't know if you mentioned that this morning when you started.
We went through each of the responses before you arrived.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm on to page 8 now. Would like to just quickly give you a picture of the students that come to community colleges. As you can see, from about age 15 to over age 65. Community colleges do serve all ages. The chart does demonstrate that over the past 2 years, the number of individuals attending is declining. This just shows you by what age group. I want to bring to your attention that middle bar, which is the largest, the 25 to 44 is where we seem to have lost the largest number of community college students. Moving on to the diversity of community college students, community colleges pride themselves in being a reflection of their community and the people that live there. The information provided here would bear that out. We serve at or over, in nearly all categories, the ethnic diversity of the population around the state. Oh, if you're looking at the slide on the wall, there. Interesting. Caucasians were not unreported. They are a percent of the population at community colleges, 83.2%. Their percent in the Oregon population is 84.6%. But we do have a section of or a portion of community college students who do not report their ethnicity at all.
Can you speak to us about the gender breakdown?
Madam Chair, I would like to bring that information back to you. It is different by different program group, and I'm afraid that I might misspeak if I say it's 52% women and 48% men, but I think that's pretty close, but I will absolutely bring that back.
Thank you.
So those are the inputs. Those are the people, students, individuals, community members that come to community colleges. I'm going to move on page 10 now to performance indicators. This slide deserves a little bit of a history lesson. In 2001, community colleges and workforce development, the department and the colleges worked to establish a set of performance indicators.
May I stop you just for a moment, and I beg your pardon. It's been called to my attention that we have a new representative present. Is it Representative Burley? Would you please come up and join the panel? Welcome. And again, please excuse the interruption.
As I was saying, the performance indicators that you have in front of you were part of Ways and Means discussion in 2001 as the legislative leadership looked to follow the governor's lead in adding $45 million additional dollars for community college enrollment. For that investment, we developed a set of performance indicators, which we called the four A's. And I mentioned these briefly yesterday. Did want to report to you the results. You do have a report in your appendix materials that were delivered to you, which is an easier to read version of the four A's. Although the As Chair Devlin said yesterday, the golden age of community college funding lasted a little more than 7 months. We have continued to track this information. Our baseline is 98-99, and I would like to hit a couple of high notes here and not cover all of these, as I know that you have them in front of you. The first two under access and affordability and student goals are important because they talk primarily about access. We made a pledge to keep and maintain an open door policy. We have lost students since 2001. We have dropped from 402,000 full headcount students to 330. Maintaining the status of the most affordable. The average tuition and fees at a community college is $2,800. We are the highest in the 15 western states. I'd also like to highlight
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. The charts we have say 373 and 330. You said 402 and 330, and could you clarify for me, please?
Yes, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, the baseline of 98-99 is 373,000. We rose to 402,000 in 2001-02.
Thank you.
And we have now dropped back.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I guess could you give me a high and a low on the average tuition? You know, you're saying we're the highest, so give me some other ranges. You know, again, are we way ahead? Is it a $10, $20, $50, $100?
There. Somewhere.
Because that's a pretty powerful statement, Madam Chair. Okay. I think we should have some.
Okay. I'm getting there. At the back of today's slides, thank you, found it at the same time, page 42 of your handout today,
I'd just like to jump ahead.
Thank you very much.
I dare say we won't be attracting any California students soon. I'm going to finish this slide very quickly, but I would like to make sure that even given the constraints, the last two on this slide, that are adaptability and workforce goals, community colleges continue to provide a high number of trainings, customized trainings for businesses, and we continue to maintain a high satisfaction rating from those employers that use the community college. 99% of employers said they would use a community college again.
Commissioner, under adaptability, the workforce goals,
where you detail the number of programs that have been suspended and those that are slated to be deleted. Is there detail somewhere that tells us what those programs are and where they're located?
Yes, Madam Chair. In order for a program to be suspended or deleted, they do file that notice with the department, and we can bring forward for you which of these programs. Are you interested as well in the new programs that have been established, or just those suspended or deleted?
The new information would be helpful as well, but I'm really keying in on impacts. The impacts of the cuts that have taken place and those that are anticipated. You keep reminding us that you're wanting to keep a face on what's happening out there around the state, and that level of detail will help us do that.
Absolutely. Thank you. Slide 11 talks about accountability, both in terms of service and in quality. I wanted to highlight what we euphemistically call in the department our penetration rate, how high of a service rate per community college district. And it ranges around the state from about 10% in very densely populated areas to a high of 14-16 in more rural communities. What we note is that our average has decreased from a penetration of about 13% over the last 2 years to a little over 11%. Quality goals I'd like to highlight are that the community college students that transfer to the university system are up from 13,000 to 16,000, and the grade point average of students entering the university system has slightly increased, and their graduation rate has gone from 68% to 72%. We've already talked about tuition, so I'll move on.
Before you do that, I want to go back to the penetration rate for a moment. Again, if you could speak to the penetration rate as it relates to access in rural Oregon. What is the experience there?
Madam Chair, with your indulgence, I would like to bring it back. I don't have that information packed away in my brain. I'll certainly bring back. You're particularly interested in rural, or would you like the statewide picture?
The statewide picture, but particularly hearing from our rural legislators, concerns about everything from distribution formula to declining access. Again, what does that picture look like?
Absolutely. And I would dare say that this information, combined with the program suspensions and deletions, is also...
Exactly.
Yeah. I'd like to now move on to the federal programs that are supported and administered through the department. I'm going to begin with the Workforce Investment Act. We talked yesterday about the function of this program. It serves unemployed and low-income adults, youth from ages 14 to 21, and dislocated workers, and it emphasizes skill gain, finding and keeping a job, and having your wage actually increase while you're on the job. The Workforce Investment Act has been in place since 2000. And as I said, it really looks at particularly for adults in getting and keeping a job. Slide 13 gives you a breakdown of the funds that are received and how much of the approximate $110 million that we receive on a biennial basis, where and who it is dedicated for. These are funds that are really not fungible. You can move a small portion of funds between adult and youth service levels, but it is fairly restricted by the Department of Labor. Slide 14. This is another input slide. It gives you the demographics for who has been served in the 2003-04 program year. And I'm going to pick up the pace here unless there's questions about. Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Page 15 breaks down the actual performance measures that are reported to the Department of Labor under the Workforce Investment Act, Title 1B. They do have performance measures for each of the programs, and although similar, they are not the same. The slide 15 shows you the performance that's required for adult and dislocated workers. Last year, the percentage of adults getting a job increased 7% over last year, so our 85% is an increase, although those keeping a job has actually declined. We also have failed to meet our yearly goal on wages. For dislocated workers, we have failed on retention and earnings replacement.
Mr. Chair. Representative Jensen.
Could you speak to me, if I'm reading the charts correctly, it's the earnings is significantly below the goal. Do you have any explanations for that that might help us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, our analysis is, let me speak first for dislocated workers.
Okay.
They tend to leave work with a higher wage, and when they return to work, they don't return at the same rate of pay that in their pre-dislocated wage. So we have historically had difficulty, particularly in a struggling economy, to return people from a high-paying job to a similar high-paying job. They either need additional training. Sometimes they are place-bound and don't choose to move from their community, and their choices are somewhat more limited. We also have found that wages are fairly stable, and wage gain becomes more difficult over time.
If I could follow up with a little clarification. And I do understand that the people leaving displaced workers would tend to leave well-paying jobs and would be hard to find those jobs. But your goal wouldn't be predicated on that, would it? I mean, your goal for the displaced worker would not necessarily be in light of the difficulty of getting to that prepaid sort of thing. I guess that's my question.
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, I believe I understand your question. The Department of Labor, when they negotiate with us, look at our history. And if we had a history of being able to place displaced workers or adults in at a particular wage, then they carry it forward and they expect us to be able to meet that or better. We have had intense discussions about the fact that our economy has yet to recover. So being held to what we did in the past, 2001, is really not fair.
Thank you.
Does that help?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordling.
Two questions, Commissioner. Can you help me understand
the adult retention rate, that drop, what's happening there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I think it is better that I try not to anecdotally answer. My sense is that the retention rate is measured at the second quarter after taking a job. And we aim that once you get that job, that you stay in that job, you know, whether you receiving whatever supports you need in order to ensure that that job is retained. And I think it's better that I bring you research to answer that question rather than try to give you something that may be inaccurate.
All right. And if I may ask an additional question, the attainment of educational or occupational skills credential, the program goal for 2002 was 60%, but the actual was the 87.8. But then the goal for 2003 was again set at 60%. But you actually got over 80%. Mm-hmm. Can you help me understand the setting of the goal?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, the Department of Labor has been in conversation with states about exactly how to measure attainment of an occupational credential as we wait for them to make their determination about how they are going to define it. We are loath to aim particularly high. In their discussions, they have said it needed to be a very narrow definition, and they have yet to implement that, but if they did, our performance would drop. And I can certainly bring you that definition that is not in place but is being discussed. So our goal is based on if they change their definition, we believe our performance would be lower.
Lower than the actual?
Lower than the 86%, because we are able to count additional credentials that they may in fact say are not countable. But they have, I don't know if threatened is the right word, but they have discussed it longer than they normally do before deciding. And so our goal is presuming that they're going to make that change.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Slide 16 talks about the Workforce Investment Act performance measures for youth. You will notice that there are two age groups for youth, the 19 to 21. The measures of performance and results there are keyed more toward employment and retention, where the 14 to 18 are attainment of skill credentials or work readiness. The number of youth completing a high school diploma or equivalent has increased from 62% to 71% last year to this year.
Can I clarify one item? I don't know if you've covered this. How do you define earnings gain in each of these?
Chair Devlin, earnings gain is based on what has been reported in the past as an average annual. Okay, making sure. And then what Oregon does, as many states, we look at that past performance and we say we believe we can maintain that, or we believe we can't maintain that particular wage, and that it can be maintained, or you could actually have a wage gain because of the training you received or the certificate that you received. If you would like, I'd be more than pleased to bring you the actual data element definition about how earnings gain and wage gain is calculated.
I'd appreciate that. It appears it's not really a measure in terms of the individual Is it directly from their previous, when they were first hired over a period of time, or is it when the past employment?
Chair Devlin, it is all of those things. It is based on an aggregate of individual pre-service wage and post-service wage.
Okay.
I'm going to move to adult basic skills. This is Title II of the Workforce Investment Act. As we mentioned yesterday, this is a program that is slated for major reductions in the President's 2006 budget. I did want to note that this particular program is delivered across the state by the community colleges. That is a bit of an anomaly nationally. Most adult basic education services are delivered through the K-12 system in other states. Oregon is one of a handful, and I'd like to crow just a moment. The Council of Advancement of Adult Literacy has recently released a case study of Oregon and counts us as a model in how to do adult literacy service. They say that because Oregon has a higher than average impact on moving an adult basic education student into either pre-collegiate or collegiate activity, and that is primarily based on the fact that they are actually at the college, and making that transition seems less dangerous, if you will, for that student. Slide 18 is an input slide, if you will. It talks about the participants and how they self-identify themselves, that nearly half of all the students that are served are between the ages of 25 and 44, a little younger population than others. And the majority of students accessing basic skills programs in Oregon are unemployed or not in the workforce at all.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Looking at English as a second language and taking into consideration that Oregon is very much a state of welcoming newcomers, if you will, do ESL programs exist across the state everywhere they are needed? Where are the gaps? If you could come back to us with that information.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, I appreciate that. We will bring you back information.
Yes. Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also note that in correctional settings we're penetrating, and if you could let us know where those programs are, that'd be great.
Chair Devlin, Representative Mark certainly will.
I would note for the record that my office has been in contact with your offices regarding adult basic skills, and without needing legislation, no legislation is needed. We've been in discussions about including some issues relative to health literacy in that program, which could be we've identified could be of considerable benefit in terms of controlling health care costs.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Chair Devlin is quite accurate. We did a review of adult basic education programs around the state and queried about how was health care or was health care part of the adult basic skill curriculum, and indeed it is. It is embedded all across the state so that individuals with low literacy skills and English as a second language know how to both read a medicine bottle, take their medicine, and interact with their physician or physician's assistant.
So we're trying to improve some of those efforts, actually.
Yes, certainly. Slide 19, again, this slide gives you the demographics of who accesses the literacy program by gender, ethnicity, and age. 60% of those individuals that are served by the adult basic education program are self-reported as non-white. The majority of them are Hispanic Latino students. On to the performance for this program. Slide 20. A highlight is that nearly 8,000 students have increased their skill and knowledge by more than two grade levels. A grade level in this particular measure, which is a federal grade level, is roughly two grade levels in Oregon and probably nationally, such as a student has moved from grade 5 to grade 7 or grade 10 to grade 12 in their literacy skill. 1,500 students who had a goal to complete their secondary education did so. And the transition from post-secondary education or training, 50% of the students who anticipated transitioning were successful in doing that. Moving on to Carl Perkins, Vocational and Technical Education Act of 1998. As we discussed yesterday, this is a program that is slated for elimination in the upcoming 2006 budget. The funds that are received by the state of Oregon are split 50-50 between the Department of Education and Secondary Schools and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development and Community Colleges. That, again, is unusual in many states. Secondary portion is larger than the post-secondary portion. It provides technical career and technical programs that provide high school and community college students high-quality skills to prepare them for in-demand jobs. You may know and have heard of these programs expressed as 2+2 and tech prep programs. Slide 22 gives you a picture of who these students are. Each of these federal programs seems to have their own vernacular or language. Here we report on post-secondary professional technical concentrators. So this is not your casual student, professional technical student. In order to be counted here, you have to be taking 50%, you have to be 50% towards a credit for a professional technical degree, and then you are a concentrator. Examples of professional technical degrees, who might be a concentrator and what might they be studying? Accounting, business, dental assisting, nursing, instructional assistant, recreational vehicle service technology, or agribusiness and management.
Or Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Court reporting.
Pardon me?
Court reporting. That's, I got my degree at U of O and got my profession at Lane Community College in court reporting, so add that to your list.
I will do that. Senator Walker, Mr. Chair.
Although, Mr. Chair, chairing the Public Safety Committee, I can tell you, hearing from our courts around the state, they're laying off or have laid off court reporters for budgetary reasons. Mm.
Mr. Chair and Madam Vice Chair, that is true. The state courts significantly whacked away at the court reporters that work in the court system and provide excellent service. But the federal courts have not seen the error of the state's ways and have retained court reporters, and also court reporters perform a service in the freelance market for attorneys. And one of the new fields that court reporters have ventured into in the last several years, which they do here at the Capitol, which I need to remind my colleagues again, is they do closed captioning. And so they do closed captioning of every session of the Senate and the House for hard of hearing people. And that's an excellent skill that court reporters provide. So we have adapted.
Mr. Chair, I would like to pause on this page and bring your attention to instructional assistant. It is important to note, as you know, no doubt heard a lot about No Child Left Behind when you were when you were discussing the Department of Education budget. Instructional assistants are now required to be certified in order to be in the classroom because of No Child Left Behind. We have used Carl Perkins dollars to bring the community colleges, high schools, and the university system together to create a career pathway for those instructional assistants who don't yet have the credential that they need in order to continue as instructional assistants. And it is it's a prideful thing, I think. On 23, the performance is listed for Carl Perkins. The actual performance generally exceeds the planned performance. We do have an exception with the retention and or completion of a post-secondary education. It's not dramatic, but I didn't want to miss it. I am often told that that could be explained because many professional technical students are hired before they finish, because the employing community is after them, and the degree, although important, is not all important.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Gordley.
It would be helpful, looking at the academic achievement measure, if that could be broken down even more. You're looking at concentrators who achieve a GPA of 2.0 or better, mm-hmm. but if we could see the categories, if we could have it broken down in a way that really helps us understand the quality that we're getting, how many are at 4 point, et cetera.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, Senator Gordley and I attended a couple of weeks ago. We had a presentation. They talked about the Florida system of community colleges and how you don't really, our objective should be helping our economic development and helping these people come out and have a job. And they talked about that they had too many people wanting to be beauticians. And so they cut down because there was too many in the market and you couldn't really make a living wage off that. So you don't really have a performance measure putting this together with the economic situation, do you, for these people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, no, we do not. I mean, that would be the fact of the matter. In order for a professional technical program to be approved to be offered in the state, it does go through a rigorous process of review and approval. And first and foremost in that approval is labor market demand. I hasten to say that cosmetology is in this state primarily provided by proprietary schools and not by community colleges. They also have an approval process, but it is different than that which a community college must go through in order for a program to be approved.
Just one follow-up. So,
yes.
So the approval process, is it by your office or is it done at the local community college? Because the demand may be different in each community, right?
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, it is done at both. It is first approved at the local college, and then and there is a process by which someone can protest that it either is there is not sufficient demand or the demand is already being met.
Thank you.
We're going to move to the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. I have another quote, because it worked so well yesterday. I have never had an OYCC youth appear before me in juvenile court. And that was a statement by Judge Janine Birch, Wheeler County Board of Commissioners, also a juvenile judge. This program, as we discussed yesterday, was enacted by the legislature in 1987. It is fashioned after the Civil Corporation Conservation Corps, the CCC, from the 30s. In the past 15 years, literally thousands of youth from all across the state have participated. They are age 13 to 24, and it is funded primarily by the lottery device tax. And as we discussed yesterday, other state and local funds. Slide 25 gives you a picture of for 2004. what students were served, both the youth that were employed in the Conservation Corps as well as their crew leaders and the camps around the state. The average age is 16 years old, and there is a community stewardship corps where the participants do receive scholarships to continue on to college, and 239 of those were awarded in 2003-04.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
I would just like to comment on what I see as progress in gaining more inclusion of racial and ethnic groups participating with the Corps. As I mentioned yesterday, one of my first assignments coming into the legislature almost 14 years ago was serving on the advisory committee for the Youth Conservation Corps, and was pretty much an all-white program, mm-hmm. and stayed that way for some period of time. And so what I see here is a reflection of a commitment to gain diversity, and whatever strategies are being employed are obviously working, and that's to the credit of the people who are there now.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Sure.
Yes.
On the nearly all community stewardship participants were dropouts or at risk of becoming dropouts. Where are they today, though? Do we have data on that?
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, I believe that in a previous slide that 50% of them have, some may still be in process, but may still be participating is a better way of saying it, but 50% of them have either received their GED or graduated from high school.
It's the next slide.
Oh, it's the next slide. I haven't gotten there. Oh, no.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Representative March. Reading ahead again. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Price-Burley, I was pleased to learn that my colleague had served on the advisory committee. I did not know that about her, and I currently serve on it myself. And I know they do a tremendous job leveraging the small amount of funds that they get. And I don't know, yesterday I had to leave and testify on a bill in another committee, and I don't know if you addressed that, how well they do at leveraging those funds. And if you didn't, could you sort of explain a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, on this very slide, it notes that OYCC has leveraged 4-to-1 every dollar that they receive in state support from the local level. So you're exactly right. They work hard at making sure that the local community is bought in to the process.
And Mr. Chair, if I might add, sometimes they can be the biggest employer in some of these small communities when they employ a lot of these children for the summer and through their programs. So they are an economic engine, as well as keeping kids on the straight and narrow and getting them through school.
Thank you, Senator. I'll make sure I pass that along, those accolades along.
Before we go on to your performance measures, there's two items. One, to back up just for a moment, on the Perkins dollars and resources that the President has not put in his proposed budget for federal fiscal year 2006, what are your community colleges basing their budgets on for those programs that would be impacted? On those dollars continuing or not continuing?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we would be best to bring you back information on that. It is the 2006 budget, so the window of opportunity to convince decision makers not to do that is about 18 months, or at least 13, 14 months now. But I will make sure that I have that conversation with the community college presidents about their intended actions.
The next item is, before we go into the performance measures, Mr. Bender had a discussion yesterday with the co-chairs of Ways and Means. I'm going to ask him to briefly just review a memo he's prepared and make sure that you have copies of that. That will be part of our discussion later in the process when we get into actually phase two, but we will be going through the performance measures that you have right now at this time, but of course we'll be reviewing those in some detail during phase two of this process. So, Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've distributed a one-page sheet to you that's titled Co-Chair's Review of CCWD Performance Measures and Program Priorities, and there are additional copies in the back there in one of those slots in the back if people are interested. The co-chairs, as you know, are going through and looking at all state agency performance measures and program priorities, and in many instances they have suggested some alternatives to the ones that the department is now tracking. And this is just a brief synopsis of their discussion, which was held yesterday, regarding the department's performance measures and program priorities. I would note that just in fundamental terms, what the co-chairs are interested in doing are, in many cases, getting additional measures that would report how clients in workforce programs and community college students are faring in the workforce after they leave the services of the community college and the workforce programs. They are also asking for some disaggregated data. Much of this, the commissioner has already shown, they maintain for the federal workforce programs and report to the federal government. But as you go through, as we go through the state performance measures, which are coming up now, those have not necessarily been added into those performance measures. So I think the co-chairs were interested in having some of those measures moved into the state performance measure system as well.
Go ahead.
And just a couple of other things. They did note that the Ways and Means Committee last session had asked, this is number one on this list, had asked the department to report whenever they had a measure that was reporting the number of persons who had achieved a particular credential, to also add a measure to report the percentage who had attempted to qualify for that. So, for example, in addition to the number of GEDs awarded, to report a measure on how many people took the test and therefore were successful. This is something that they're again asking the department to move forward on, and also move forward on some requests for information that's supplied by region and by particular college. Those were the changes they suggested. There were also a couple changes they suggested in the program priority list, which maybe we can get to later when we discuss that portion.
I should point out that these are recommendations from the co-chairs. They're by no means a list that's going to be incorporated directly into performance measures. We will have a discussion in some detail of existing and proposed performance measures. In fact, the way it's looking, this committee is going to spend a lot of time on performance measures because the organizations that have been before us before, particularly the Department of Education, came in with an understanding basically that even before they came into the building, that their existing performance measures had to be modified, and that we're going to be going through a process to look at performance measures not only for the Department of Education but for the state school fund. And I think there's going to be a relatively close look at community colleges and workforce development, so I just wanted to put the committee on notice that we're going to be spending a lot of time on performance measures.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I want to say on the record today that I support the direction that the co-chairs are giving
to this committee, and to others. And as I look at items 1 and 4 on this list, and I reflect back on some of the questioning from Representative Wisnot, I think the direction that the co-chairs are giving, pushing, is directly related to where we're trying to get to. Not wishing to speak for Representative Wisnot, but we seem to share a lot of thinking and ideas about how we can unpack some of the information that we're getting.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, one of the in looking through this, one of the things that kind of bothers me about this is the reporting of the percentage of community college students or the who go on to transfer to Oregon University System. And I see this in two of the performance measures really quickly here. I think that, first off, it strikes me as being awfully ethnocentric to confine it to the Oregon University System. There may be some more ease of keeping that or getting that data, but the performance of community colleges is not necessarily to be downgraded because they keep the kids in the Oregon University System when some job, some career, or physical therapy, as an example, has very limited opportunity, and I think none of the university system have in Oregon have that track. So they very well may go out of state. And I know in my area there are, and partially compliments of this tuition thing that we're dealing with, again, there are many of our students, and I'm not sure I can speak for the community college, but there are many of our students that are going out of state because it's, quite frankly, cheaper to go out of state. And if they do go to Blue Mountain or wherever it happens to be and then transfer to universities outside of the state of Oregon, the community college has still done its job.
I would agree, Representative Jensen, and I think obviously another issue is there is what you've pointed out too in your statement is that the measure more clearly should also be a reflection of those students who entered into a two-year program with the idea of continuing on to college to a four-year college and not in any way diminishing the value of a two-year associate's degree or particularly an associate degree that's gained to go into a particular occupation or profession where there may be no necessity to go on to a four-year degree to practice in that area. I did want to emphasize, though, that at least in speaking to the co-chair for the Senate, he clearly recognized that this is the direction that they wanted to go in, but he clearly recognized that this committee had an active role in molding these performance measures and interacting with the parties that would actually be impacted by these performance measures. They're trying to set a direction. They're not trying to dictate word for word what is going to be in a performance measure. So with that, did we have any more, or did you have any more?
No.
No, okay. Go ahead and proceed on your report.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I did appreciate that LFO facts, LFO staff did give me a heads up to this list last evening, and so I have had a chance to at least look over it and cogitate on how hard or how easy it will be to collect this information. I do appreciate that. Thank you, Steve. We've been talking about performance measures, which measure either federal or state those things that we have decided are important to know if we are getting the results from the public investment. All of these performance measures, in my mind, come together under the rubric of the Oregon benchmarks. As you well know, and was restated in Oregon Chimes 2, that Oregon has three overarching goals, and that is quality jobs for all Oregonians, safe, caring, and engaged communities, healthy and sustainable surroundings. Of those three goals, the first, quality jobs for all Oregonians, seems to be where the community colleges and workforce development system finds itself most heavily embracing. You should have what I consider a very word-dense slide in front of you, and that would be the Oregon benchmarks that are either our related benchmarks or high-level outcomes. The list that begins down the left-hand side, OBM, that would be Oregon Business or Oregon Benchmark number 3, and then a statement of what that benchmark is, and so down the line. These are the benchmarks that the department tracks and reports on. In the governor's recommended budget, there is a full report with in some level of detail that we did not bring forward here today, but certainly expect that our conversation will include that in a future phase. But I did want to walk through quickly how the agency goals are connected to key performance measures that are connected to the Oregon benchmarks. That sound reasonable? Okay. Goal number one, Oregonians will have strong literacy skills. The next column shows you the Oregon benchmark number that it is attached to, or the high-level outcome. Then you have actual alliteration of the performance measure. I mean, this was a number of GED certificates issued annually. As the columns progress, you can see that it has been a performance measure for the department since the year 2000, whether it's new or modified, and then a value. You have there a 2000 value. They have a 2003 value. Okay, that's good. And a 2005 target.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd be a little careful about calling these high-level measures when you're doing counting.
Good point.
Thank you.
The second performance measure is the percentage of enrolled at-risk youth who remain or return to school. This is reflective of some of the federal performance measures that we have. It was new in 2002, and we are on track to accomplish our target. Number 27, the number of students completing a level of basic skill or ESL. It has been a performance measure for a long time, and we are also on track with the 10,294.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
I'd like to go back to the GED certificates. In today's world, I'm struggling with how to frame this. Well, what is the value of a GED in today's world?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I laugh not at your question, but because of a very real occurrence that's very personal to me and to my able assistant, Dr. Connie Green, and it might help for her just to tell that story because it is emblematic, if you wouldn't mind.
For the record, I'm Connie Green with Community Colleges and Workforce Development. I've been in the community college business for about 30 years. I've done about everything anyone behind me has done one day or one year or something, and I believe in them. GEDs are very, very important to our communities because many students drop out. when they have to go back to high school, they're at a different point in their mind and in their hearts and in their personal and social development. And what they want is that equivalency that says, I can do high school work, let me move on and get to post-secondary. So we find our GEDs are extremely helpful for students who want to get on with post-secondary. We also find that every 5 years they get statewide and nationally correlated to the high school graduation levels. So the GED today is not the GED 5 years ago or 10 years ago. The personal story is I have a son and a daughter. This is about my son, who is 17, had all of his SIM standards passed at the ninth grade, has a 1.0 GPA, is ADHD, has a very difficult time turning things in, is very frustrated with high school because he's ready to do other kinds of things. Have him in IB classes, and they are very challenging, but at the same time, they are not getting where he needs to go. So this week, we went through the process of taking him out of South Salem High School, releasing him from high school at 17, and getting him into a GED program. When we did the pre-GED test yesterday, I was testifying actually with Senator Walker's committee on Senator Gorley's bill. He comes into the office. I wasn't there. Cam got to be the one to see him. Two thumbs up. He passed pre-GED test, high scores, ready to go next week to get it so he can enroll spring term at Chemeketa as a post-secondary student. He's ready to move on. The story we're laughing about was it wasn't easy. I had to use a variety of my hats of knowledge, and including being the past assistant commissioner, to even change one of our rules to say this is dumb on a few forms. So it was a two-hour, three-hour process of knowing all the players at Chemeketa and at South and at the community colleges to even get him out of school and into where he needs to be. So Monday there were tears. By Tuesday, for a mother. By Tuesday, we're excited. By next week, he'll have the test done and ready to go at Chemeketa and go on. High school is not for everybody, Senator Gorley, as you know. High school does make a difference. And the right kids who need high school need to stay there. Other kids need to move on when they're ready, and GEDs let you do that.
Mr. Chair, stories are very powerful, and thank you for sharing that one. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It's my understanding that to apply to post-secondary school, community college, or university, that you have to have a high school diploma or a GED equivalent. Is that not true? In addition to taking the SAT or ACT or whatever it is.
Senator Devlin, Senator Walker, if you want to go to an OUS or a private university, you have to have a GED or high school degree. At the community colleges, for your ability to benefit, to get financial aid, you have to show that you can do post-secondary work. So the GED comes in extremely helpful. Do community colleges permit people to enter, take post-secondary classes without a GED? Yes, we do. That's part of that open door. However, they have to pass our placement test that says you're post-secondary ready as well. So we have placement of classes. So you've got two things happening. One is you need it. You also need it for jobs. Many employers only want to hire you if you have a GED or high school degree.
Thank you.
Brings up a question that just came up. In terms of our dropout rate, which no one would really want to brag about in high school, a fair number of students are categorized as having stayed in school all throughout the years, but not graduating because they lacked the appropriate credits to be able to graduate. Do we do anything to basically target those students because they're in school? We know they're getting out. We know who they are. Do we do anything to... Is there any effort between community colleges and high schools to target those youth, particularly those that have stayed in school, but just for some reason or not, just don't qualify to graduate?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to attempt to answer your question with the answer yes. There is all across the state, I believe, very good dialogue and conversation between high schools and community colleges about those students who are ready to move on to post-secondary work and those who might be caught in such a position where they don't have sufficient credit. If I let Connie have the mic back, she would tell you about her daughter who lacked three credits or two credits for graduation, who also went to Chemeketa and took some online classes and earned the credit that she needed so she could graduate from high school. So, again, that's a example of, but just one.
Please, if you want, if you'd like to. Or
we continue?
Yes.
I think I was at the bottom of page 28, yes? 28. The number of students who successfully complete community college courses in word processing spreadsheet software, again, well on track to meet that particular performance measure. Okay. I have been informed that the handout that they have, as well as the slide, has some inaccurate numbers. So you're getting a new handout coming around that has been corrected. So we're on agency goal number two, Oregonians, or Oregon's workforce is well-trained and has access to a wide variety of training programs. This is connected to three different Oregon benchmarks. Key performance measure measures the Small Business Development Center clients and assistance to them. This is a new measure. We have a target, but we don't yet have a value for 2003. Benchmark 29, the performance measure percent of participants ranking WIA-funded current workforce trainings good or better. It's been a performance measure since 2002. We have a value of 92%. Our target is 90%. Again, on benchmark number 29, the percent of companies ranking training that they receive from community colleges as good or better. We have discussed this one. Our value is 98%. Our goal is 93%. Measure 25, the percent of community college students passing national licensing and certification tests. It is not new. It has been a performance measure since 2000. The target is 94%, and we are on target. Number 25, the number of professional technical degrees or certificates awarded. A new measure in 2002, the value was 4,178, and the value for 2003 is we are on target and a little surpassing it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I believe this is where the co-chair's review kind of comes into play. In these raw numbers, just tell us numbers, but percentages would be helpful. And if you want to go a step above, you could say percentage achieving it within a certain time frame.
Yes, you could. Goal number three, all Oregonians have access to excellent, affordable community college services. This is connected to benchmark number 24. Oregon's rank for community college tuition and fees among all Western states. Our hope is to be the eighth highest. We are now the highest. The next one is the number of high school students enrolled in community college credit programs. It's a performance measure since 2000. Our target is 22,000. We're a bit shy of that, but making progress at 13,600. And the last key performance measure is racial and ethnic minorities enrolled in community colleges as a percent of the state average. Again, not a new percentage. Our value is that we are at or above the percent of the population as indicated there in values for 2003, and we are at the 2005 target. A new slide that was added to your packet this morning is a response to the performance budget note that was also indicated in the co-chair's comments. We have been in conversation with the Oregon Progress Board about these performance measures, and I regret to say that we did not finish our conversation with them and did not get them established as performance measures, but we did bring forward to you the information that we have on each of them. The community colleges, as I have talked both yesterday and today, have worked with our OUS partners for at least the past 20 years to make sure that students who transfer succeed, and we are in the process of making that tracking easier and more efficient. And we believe that the integrated data system that we will be talking about in phase two will assist with that. In studies that have been done over the last 15 years, Oregon Community College transfer students do as well or better than what have typically been called native students that start in the OUS system. If you would like, I can certainly review the accomplished under the performance budget notes where it has both the number of students, so it has the universe and the percentage of students for the passing state or national licensing standards.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would it be possible to have some sort of a breakdown on what these license credentials are, sort of thing, and to just give us a little idea of what we're looking at?
Sure.
I assume the nursing might be one of one of the those, but indeed, some of the others.
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, yes, indeed, we can bring that back to you.
Thank you.
Noting the time, I would certainly take some time to go through these if that's the interest to the committee, since you didn't have it previously.
I think noting the time, I can assure you that everyone on the committee can read. And, and so noting the time, maybe we should progress on unless there are questions about.
I'm going to move now to discussion of the criteria and the budget priority reductions as requested by legislative fiscal. Slide 31.
Just one moment, so that that the audience understands, is that, and so I defend legislative fiscal. It's not actually requested by legislative fiscal. It's actually requested by the co-chairs, and I believe relates to a former piece of legislation passed. We ask for a 10% reduction package from literally all departments, mm-hmm. everyone that appears before subcommittees. It does not mean that we are planning on cutting 10% from everyone that appears before a subcommittee. It just tries to give us an indication of what the priorities that the agency believes are priorities and how they identify them in those 10% reductions. But the legislative fiscal officer is not the one responsible for the request. We are. Okay.
Chair Devlin, thank you. That's very appropriate. The department used our agency mission statement and the governor's principles as the criteria for where we look to make our reductions. and those are listed on slide 31. I have provided a group of slides that gives you a historical look of our budget. 32 is budget by fund type, so you can see it's been relatively stable. We did have an increase in our federal funds and a decrease in our general funds over the last four biennium. Slide 33 is a look individually at the other funds. And slide 34 is the same display with federal resources.
Would it be fair to say that most of those federal resources went into your workforce efforts and not to community colleges directly for, I mean, they're still going into those, but it's not like they're fungible funds that you can use for any purpose?
Mr. Chair, you're exactly right.
We can't lower core community college students' tuition using those funds.
Correct. That's correct. The majority of the funds received, the federal funds that are received, particularly for Title I-B, are allocated to a set of service providers that in the majority are not the community college, although the community college does provide the majority of training that is purchased with Title I-B dollars. I'm on page 35 then. The budget reductions for the general fund. The majority of the state general fund that comes to the Department of Community College and Workforce Development, 98% plus, is the Community College Support Fund. The governor's recommended budget is at $393 million. $388 million would actually become the Community College Support Fund. The balance of that, about 1.3%, funds the agency operations and debt service. A 10% reduction to the $388 million is $38.8 million, and we have dispersed, if you will, or prorated that reduction to the Community College Support Fund and the three different elements of the support fund. So there are currently three major pots of money, if you will, and we took a proportional share cut from each one, whatever share they make up of the whole. So the student support, which is the what we call the money that follows the student, is $31 million. Of the 38 would be $31 million, $4.5 million from equalization, $2.9 million from the base, small school and school factor size. So that's our prioritization. And it probably bears noting that I am presenting these in the way in which we, as I believe we were instructed, the way in which we would add back. So this is our first priority to have funded. The budget reduction priorities 5 through 9 are federal funds and other funds. A 10% reduction to the Workforce Investment Act would be $12 million over the biennium. It would be $1.2 million from adult basic skills. We currently have $12 million in our current office operations, which is a conglomeration of all of our funds. We would reduce that by $964,000. The second office operations, the number 8, is a $275,000 reduction. As we have, we're authorized some positions in the governor's recommended budget, we would get those back. Number 9, the Carl Perkins grant, a 10% reduction from the dollars that we receive from Carl Perkins is $930,000. Yes. On to page 37.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The federal and other funds here, particularly the federal funds, are not tied directly to state general fund dollars. In other words, if we cut general fund, it doesn't result in an automatic cut to the federal funds. Is that correct?
Chair Devlin, Representative March, that is correct.
So this exercise of going through the cutting the federal funds in your instance is just an exercise. I mean, there's no reason for us to turn down 10% in federal funds in this setup.
Chair Devlin, Representative March, I certainly hope it is an exercise. Yes. Because
Thanks.
It is
and
not.
Representative March would also emphasize that in another subcommittee that's meeting close to us, not having the general funds to match federal funds in human services actually equals losing an enormous amount of federal funds.
That's not the case here.
We should have been a little more discretionary in our instructions, Mr. Co-Chair. Chair.
Just to finish on the budget reduction priorities, number 10, the Youth Conservation Corps. Other fund reduction here would be $202,000. And the debt service proportional share would be $225,000. I doubt that we could not pay that, so that would likely be absorbed somewhere else. And number 12, capital construction. We have in the governor's recommended budget resources for 6 community colleges. Reduction there would be 341.
Yes, that's in March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The debt service, are these Article 11 bonds? For the most
Chair
part?
Devlin, Representative March, yes, they are, and they are. This is debt service that was purchased in the 60s and 70s, refinanced in the mid-90s, and this is the tail end of that Article 11G.
And so, and Mr. Chair, I think we've discussed this before, that if we didn't fund these out of the general fund, the state would have to make that up with a statewide property tax under the Constitution.
Yes, that's true, Representative March, and clearly, that's a hypothetical discussion, because I think there would be both ramifications in the public if we if we did that, and there may be ramifications within our bond rating if we didn't pay the bonds how we originally had intended.
I think they primarily want them paid.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The total reduction from the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development equals $54,665,925. That's including all funds. We have reviewed the performance measures and the success of students, workers, and businesses. And now we've reviewed the budget reductions as was requested. I have received a note that you might wish to delay hearing from Dr. Schutte from Chemeketa. She would be next in our lineup, if at your discretion.
I have a feeling that there may be a lot of questions for Dr. Schutte.
Yeah.
And I also know that I will have also 6 other presidents here or their board members on Monday for the capital improvement projects that are in the governor's proposal. What I'd like to do is, given that if she started now, she would only have about 10 minutes, I'd like to plan on about 20 to 25 minutes first thing Monday morning, committee starting right at 8:30, and then we will go through the capital projects in about an hour and a half. The reason being, I do believe that the committee is going to have some questions for Dr. Schutte, because she's going to talk to some extent about the importance of community colleges, the impact of the governor's budget, and she can make some statements, to be fair, that you cannot make being a member of the executive department. So if that would be okay with Dr. Schutte, I'd like to do that, and if we believe we can do the capital in an hour and a half. We will be spending quite a bit of time on the capital proposal, since it has been quite a long time since the state has actually participated in capital projects with community colleges. So, Are there any additional questions for the commissioner?
Yes. Just
an observation. We know that many of our students leaving community colleges choose an Oregon University System institution, but there are also those students who choose a private institution in Oregon. Do we have data that tells us what that picture looks like, so that again we have a fuller picture of what that seamless educational system looks like for students in Oregon?
Chair Devlin and Senator Gordley, Oregon does participate in a service called the National Clearinghouse, and data entered there comes from everywhere, public and private. We haven't been a statewide all 17 college member for a particularly long time, but some colleges have had a historical relationship. We will bring back to the committee information that we have available to us, with the caveat that it may not be as rich as it may be 2 years from now on that very question.
I would find that very useful. I'm thinking, for example, that I believe it's still true that around half of Oregon's teachers are trained or get their training in private institutions now. So, again, something's happening out there in the marketplace, if you will. Help us understand what's going on.
We'll do our best.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? For purposes of staying under the rules, I'm going to extend the hearing on Senate Bill 5506 till Monday, which is the budget bill for the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, so we can hear Dr. Shute's testimony on Monday. And we will also be hearing a testimony relative to the capital improvements projects on Monday. So with that, if there is nothing else for the committee, we are adjourned.